ABC Local Radio with Mark Sutton.
And good morning to you. How are you?
I'm very well. Tell me, what did you think when you heard that the next play you were going to be in, or that they wanted you to be in, was a play with barely any dialogue until really the second act? There's a little bit at the start of the first act, a little bit at the start of the second act. Did you think, how are they going to pull this off?
Oh, I thought, what an easy gig.
Boy, were you wrong.
Boy, was I wrong. I was intrigued. I thought, oh, I've never read anything like this. I've never seen anything like it. I wonder how they're going to do it. And so that's enough to make you think, well, I think it's something that I want to be a part of. The other thing was that I was performing in another play, 9 shows a week, whilst rehearsing for this one for 4 weeks with the overlay. So I thought, well, that'll be easy. This play's got no lines to learn. So, but it was actually much, much more challenging than we anticipated.
We'll get to that other play in a moment, the Appleton Ladies Potato Race. You were helped out in a way that one of your co-stars in that is also in Smallmouth Sounds.
That's right. We've decided we only want to work together from now on.
What a great idea.
Oh, well, we get on so well. Mm. We're like sisters. So it, that was terrific. So we had a partner in crime. So we'd sort of race from one rehearsal to a show, back to rehearsals and so forth. So it was much more doable, I think, and much more enjoyable having somebody to go crazy with.
Yeah, the wonderful Amber McMahon.
Yeah, she's extraordinary.
Tell me, how unusual is it for you or for an actor, actress, to actually be in kind of 2 shows at once, that you're performing in one and you're rehearsing another one?
I've never done it before. And when I was offered Smallmouth Sounds, I did call a couple of friends. I called Heather Mitchell, who's a very good friend of mine, who is an extraordinary actress, as we know, and asked her if she'd ever done it before and can you survive it? And she said, you can survive it, just. And if you want to do it, you just have to work out, you know, scheduling, which I did. And then, of course, I have a third job, which is, you know, raising 2 teenagers and a husband to juggle. So it's been quite a sort of fraught couple of months, but yeah. Well worth it, well worth it.
So tell me more about this, because it's, I want to know, when you said, oh, this will be easy, you know, no lines to learn, but in fact, the lines help you negotiate your way around the stage. And if you don't have them, you don't have those kind of props, those placeholders to help you work out what you're going to do, do you?
Exactly. The script is actually quite pedantic in actual fact. Even though it doesn't have any dialogue as such, it still has a lot of stage direction. So it will say things like, Joan looks perturbed. You know, Jane reaches for her book. And so there's all of these sort of little placeholders that we have to adhere to, and then we have to sort of layer it after that. So we think, well, okay, I look perturbed, and then later on I have to figure out why it is I do that and what motivates me to get to that point. So it has to be choreographed like a dance, actually. You've got 6 people doing all of this sort of intricate, nuanced, silent performance, and then we have to sort of choreograph them all together so that the audience knows what is meant to catch their eye at one particular point. Because if it's just 6 people doing extraneous things, it can be very confusing for an audience. You think, well, what am I meant to see? Mm-hmm. But Joe's been very clever in making one piece of action sort of come to the fore and the rest go back, and then something else come to the fore on the other side of the stage. And so I describe it as, you know, like a conductor conducting an orchestra where sort of, you know, one instrument will come forward and then mill back into the melody and so forth. So it actually was quite time-consuming and intricately directed.
Joe is the director. Joe Turner is the director, who also has an offstage role, a really important offstage role,
indeed,
as this guru, you might say, of the retreat that you're going on, the 6 people there at this silent retreat. And you say, yeah, it's like this sort of orchestra, and you're making sure that, well, maybe you need to look at you for a moment while somebody else is doing something else. But isn't that one of the great joys of the stage, is that you don't have to just look where the movie director wants you to look. You can look wherever you like.
Absolutely. And people say that with this play, you could come back and see it 3 or 4 times and actually watch one character for the whole play and have a different experience each time you return to the theatre, because we're all, you know, working our own little ribbon of story. it's voyeuristic. For the audience, it's kind of a voyeuristic experience, I think. But I'm making it sound quite pious.
It's very funny.
Yeah. It's very funny and hopefully quite moving. And so it's kind of got a bit of everything. So it's not up itself.
You say it's quite voyeuristic in a way. There is one scene in particular that might be considered to be voyeuristic. There is a full frontal nude scene. We should warn people about that.
Yes. Mum, it's not me.
It is not you. It is a male full frontal nude scene.
Yep.
Have you ever been asked to do a nude scene in a play?
No. I did Shirley Valentine last year, and I think the first thing I said to the director when he said, "Would you like to do it?" "I'm not stripping off." He said, no, it's not in the script. It's totally voluntary. So I've never, and actually I said this in the dressing room last night, I've never even been on stage with a fully naked person before. Yeah. I do musicals, for goodness sake. People don't, unless you're doing hair, nobody's naked. So, yeah, new experience.
What happens in the rehearsal for the play when there's a nude scene? Is it always nude, or is it nude only on stage on the night?
Well, I don't know what happens all the time, but Georgie, who plays the character, he'd sort of strip down to his jocks.
Right, okay.
Probably. So we got the idea, but, he, you know, he kept his modesty. And then we also had an intimacy coach who came in to work with us, and particularly with Georgie and Amber, who have quite an intimate scene.
Offstage, we should point out.
To choreograph that and coordinate all of that so that everybody felt safe. And
is that kind of hashtag Me Too? Or was that happening before that?
It's now it's a required element to a rehearsal room.
In romantic scenes, not even nude scenes, it's just you've got to make sure it's being done right.
Yep. Yep. So the rules around that kind of thing are much more stringent now. So I think it's been incorporated on film sets and things like that for quite some time, but it's certainly an element to a theatre rehearsal space now.
Yep. Sharon Millerchip is our guest. Small Mouth Sounds is the play, which is six people on a silent retreat under the direction of a guru. I wondered how it was going to happen, how they were going to work it, and I thought it was done superbly. There is a little bit of talk. In fact, there's a long scene at the start of Act Two where someone is talking that I thought, well, okay, it was nice to hear, but I wanted to go back to the silent scenes.
Isn't that surprising?
Yeah.
When you realise how satisfying it is to watch people working things out and telling stories in that sort of very subtle, nuanced way. Mm. And it's only one act, though.
Yeah.
There is no interval.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But it feels like first and second half, I guess. It's 90 minutes through.
That's right, which is my favourite kind of play.
Me too.
It's 90 minutes, no interval. Because, yes, there is an act one and act two. It's not split by an interval.
That's right, yeah.
So how do you go about rehearsing one and playing in the other? How is it that you keep, you know, these two scripts in your head? Can you keep more than two scripts in your head at one time?
I don't think so. Although it's funny, I mentioned Shirley Valentine earlier, and because that's a one-woman show and it was 2 hours of just me gabbling on in this Scouse accent, it's still all in there. So I still remember it, absolutely. And I sometimes use it as a vocal warm-up for the shows that I'm doing at the moment just because it warms up my mouth and my larynx and my brain.
Come on, say something for us.
You know, I like a glass of wine while I'm doing the cooking, don't I, Wall? Don't I like a glass of wine while I'm preparing the evening meal? Chips and egg. Yeah. So, you know, because she talks so quickly, so it's a good little warm-up. But I thought it's interesting that it's still there. It's sort of, it's in the hard drive, I guess, and then you can kind of call on it when you need to. But with Small Mouth Sounds and the Ableton Ladies Potato Race, I think because they were stylistically so different, we were able to sort of compartmentalise one, you know, zip on the suit of the potato race and then shed it for the rehearsal space for the other. So, yeah, I'm not sure how we did it, but we made it.
If you are in the audience of a play or a musical that you have starred in and somebody gets sick or injured and they say, is there a Shirley Valentine in the house, could you then go on stage and say, yep, I know this, I know the dialogue, I know the script, I could do it for you? Or if you're in, you know, any of the millions of musicals that you've been in over the years, it seems, really big, big-name musical, Chicago, for example, if there was, unfortunately, someone gets injured or hurt or sick or whatever, could you go on?
I don't know. I've never tested the theory. Touch wood. It makes my heart beat very fast to think I would be put under that kind of pressure. It would be in there. It would be in there. I think it would take a little rejigging, sparking the memory. I might need some prodding here and there. But I do think largely a lot of it is in the muscle memory. For instance, I did Cats in 1988 and I still remember so much of the choreography. It's just in there. If I had to get up and do it, I'd do it badly.
Come on.
But I'd do it.
I'm giving you this opportunity now. Something more recently then, obviously, is the Appleton Ladies Potato Race, written by our wonderful colleague Melanie Tate. Tell me, why do you think that show, which was sold out every performance, got rave reviews? Why do you think it struck such a chord?
Oh, I'm only guessing. But I think, firstly, it's just such a fascinating story, such an interesting premise for a play. It's based on a true story. It's written by Mel Tate, who grew up in a country town and writes so beautifully. And these characters were just so beautifully drawn. And people came to see the play and saw themselves up there. They saw Australia, the Australia that they love. And perhaps in some ways it's sort of this, you know, romantic notion we have about ourselves and about people from country towns. And it was heartwarming and it was moving and funny. It just ticked a whole lot of boxes. We sold out, actually, even before we'd started rehearsing. So there was the idea of it sounded good, and I think people were interested in the combination of actors involved. Priscilla Jackman, who was directing it, had just had a great success with Steel Point Turning at the
starring
STC. Starring Heather Mitchell. And so a lot of people's ears pricked up because of that. But then, of course, once we opened and the reviews and the word of mouth was so glowing, it just you couldn't beg, borrow or steal a ticket. So they're planning on a return, I'd say.
I hope so. The story, for those who may not know, is about the fact that in this fictional country town of Appleton, there is a race every year where men carry potato sacks on their back and they win $1,000. Whoever wins the race gets $1,000. The women carry a sack of potatoes and only got $200. And there's an attempt to equalise the prize money. And that does not go down all that well in this town.
Yeah, I think Mel just thought, because it's a true story, she just thought it'll be a feel-good thing for the town. Everybody will say, oh, good on you, Mel. She just thought she'd put some money tins around town and just raise the difference. Just, you know, a feel-good sort of thing. But she absolutely underestimated the tornado that she was going to start. And it obviously unearthed a whole lot of deep-seated feelings about loss of identity and all sorts of different things. It was really interesting.
I think one of the reasons it was successful, though, is because it was a problem that was solved. And it was solved, with a little bit of rancor at times, but basically, unlike so many of the terrible problems in society, this one was solved There's a great ending.
It's true, yeah. There was a point at the end of the show where I'm sitting on the edge of the stage and there's action happening behind me and I can see all of the audience. I actually eyeball all the audience. They're not looking at me. They're looking behind me. And I actually look at the faces. Everybody was just beaming and people were wiping tears. And because people say, oh, you're an actor. Oh, you know, you bring so much joy to people. And sometimes that feels, I don't know, I think there's much more important jobs. But in that moment when I was looking, I thought, wow, we've actually brought a real happiness and a magic to these people today in this two hours, and that made me feel really great. It was a beautiful experience.
Sharon Millerchip is our guest. So before that, at the ensemble, you were in Shirley Valentine that you mentioned. Now, that is a one-woman show, and you've got the whole dialogue. How different is that to a show where there's no dialogue, but you're sharing the stage with other people?
Just in a literal sense, something like Small Mouth Sounds, you can't prepare ahead of time. So all of the choices that you make, you have to make in the room, on the floor, with the other actors, with the director. I mean, it really sort of, it all comes together. The pieces of the puzzle happen on the floor in the rehearsal room.
In fact, I noticed you dropped a couple of lollies. And so, you know, your colleagues have to kind of work with that. And it's no big deal, but, you know, that is something that maybe you hadn't planned for in rehearsal. It's just you've got to go with it on the night.
That's it. So we have to make sure every part of us are switched on. We're hypersensitive. You know, we're really looking out for each other. And because we have no speech, all of the other senses are working in overdrive, obviously. Mm-hmm. So it's quite draining in a way.
So then when it's just you on stage and you have to remember every line and there's nobody there to prompt you, how do you do that?
Well, Shirley, I mean, I knew I knew that I needed to know my lines before I started rehearsals. So I put in really a couple of months of rehearsal, you know, maybe an hour a day, 2 hours a day, just in my room, just learning it, because there's no, the other thing is it's just a rambling conversation. Yeah. So sometimes she jumps back and forwards. So there's quite often no rhyme or reason to where she goes. So I had to, it had to be in my body. It had to be in my muscle memory. My mouth almost needed to know where it was going ahead of my brain, because what that did for me was it allowed all of my brain space to be devoted to being in the moment, to being truthful and real, and no part of it was delegated to what's next. Do you know what I mean? Because in real life, we don't have that. We, you know, we act absolutely spontaneously, and I wanted it to look like that, that every thought I was having was happening in the moment. And I knew that for me, I could do that only when the words were so secure. So the first day of rehearsal, I pretty much knew the script, and then we had, you know, 4 weeks to just flesh it out and create a performance. But it, the other thing was that the Scouse accent, which I thought would be easy, but was quite a bit harder than I thought.
You channel the Beatles, don't you?
That's what it was, yeah. Go to Liverpool, yeah.
You have been one of our leading performers for, well, 20 years, if not more.
Hush your mouth. I'm only 20 now.
But you got great reviews for Shirley Valentine. When I saw it, I was knocked out. I thought it was brilliant. You were fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
And it's hard not to love the character when it's a one-woman show, in a way, as well. Were you surprised that there was such an unbelievable outpouring of love and great reviews for that performance?
It's something you hope for, but you can't know ahead of time. I'm always a mess of self-doubt, and opening night you think, oh, am I dreadful? And I don't know, maybe that little bit of insecurity is what makes you strive to be the best you can be. Look, Willie Russell, who wrote the script,
yeah.
I mean, just writes so beautifully for women. And one of my favourite musicals of all time, which is called Blood Brothers, he wrote that as well. So indeed. I knew the script was just a diamond. If I could just honour the script, if I could just keep her truthful and not try to reinvent the wheel, just be really truthful and know her and be her, then I knew the combination would be potent, and it kind of was. And I miss her. I love her. You know, it looks like we're going to do her again. So, yeah, maybe elsewhere around Australia. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'll get to use those 2 hours of dialogue I've learned, won't I?
Sharon Millerchip, star also of Chicago, Beauty and the Beast, West Side Story, Sweet Charity, Rocky Horror Show, Into the Woods, They're Playing Our Song. As you say, mostly, well, they're all musicals. Mm. Is it unusual to slip between plays and musicals? Are there a lot of leading ladies who do the same thing?
Apparently not, because people keep saying to me, it's really quite, to be honest, I think it's changing. But for many, many years, what if you did musicals, that's what you did. You weren't really considered for anything other than that, certainly for straight acting things. But I decided it was something that I really wanted to do, because I thought even in music theatre, I love to sing and I love to dance, but what really rocks my boat is the storytelling. It's the acting. That's what I loved. And I wanted to see if I could do that. And the ensemble theatre, I have to say, have just been so supportive of me and gave me my first opportunity to do a straight play, and then have had me back several times since then, and now working with the Darlinghurst Theatre, which is a real thrill, actually. So, yeah, it doesn't happen as often as perhaps it should. It is, once you get stuck in music theatre, you're stuck in music theatre.
Some of those shows, you stepped into someone else's role,
mm-hmm.
quite often Caroline O'Connor.
Yeah.
And some others, you originated the role on that particular run. What's the difference between the two?
I suppose my process is exactly the same. I guess there's always a little bit of extra pressure, I guess, when you're stepping into big shoes. But I've never felt a pressure to replicate anybody else's performance. You know, taking over Velma Kelly from Caroline all those years ago, of course it was so daunting because Caroline had been so rapturously received and it was such an iconic role. And so I had to dismiss all of that and just have my own take on it, start from the page and work my way up from there and try to, you know, shrug all of that off. You have to. I'm not up there to impersonate anybody.
I'm not talking about Caroline necessarily, but have you ever sat in the audience of one of these shows and think, I can do better than that and I'm going to get my chance?
Oh, I guess there's an element of that. Well, because you maybe being a part of a performer, even when you're sitting in the audience, you're still the performer. And so, you know, you can kind of transport yourself up onto the stage and perhaps see you up there. And it's not a competitive thing at all. It's just perhaps it's an ambitious thing. You see a role and you think, oh, I'd like a piece of that. I can get my teeth stuck into that.
You've won 3 Helpman Awards. What do you think about when you're in the audience and they're going to read out the names?
Oh, I'd pretty much just rather be anywhere else in the whole world, because if you don't win, well, that feels rotten. And if you do win, then you have to get up and give a speech, and that's even more daunting. So either way, it's an excruciating experience, I think. It's lovely to win them, but I think the waiting for names to be called out is pretty excruciating. I think anybody would say the same.
Do you have a speech prepared?
I do, because I'm not somebody who likes to wing things. I'm not an off-the-cuff type of girl. I'm a little bit too control freak for that.
You like to have a script?
At least a template of what I would like to say when I'm up there, so that it doesn't take me completely by surprise.
You know, when you see someone win an award and then they just run through a litany of thank yous, people think that's boring, but given that it's such a collaborative process, how can you avoid that?
Yeah. I mean, I guess in a perfect world, you find some slightly poetic way to make a narrative around all of that and include all the people that you want to thank as well. Mm-hmm. So that it's, you know, at the end of the day, I'm an entertainer, so I probably can't help it. Even when I'm giving a speech, I like to be entertaining in some way.
Sharon Millichip is currently starring in Small Mouth Sounds at the Darlinghurst Theatre. As we've mentioned, there's not a lot of dialogue. There's a little bit later on, but for the first two-thirds of the play, there's not a lot. You know, when you go to acting school, you're taught mime and movement. That's the first thing. How often would you actually use that until you get to a show like this one?
Yeah, not very often, I guess. And it's hard to get right, too, because you think, well, I want to make all these facial expressions that tell story, but I have to make them absolutely real and naturalistic. Otherwise, I am just up there doing a panto act. So finding that balance was quite tricky. And it's interesting, you know, I thought, because when you're up there, sometimes I'm thinking, wow, I can hear laughter and I know it's not me. There's business going on down the other end of the line of chairs here, because my husband said last night, he said, oh, I wondered if it was going to be a bit boring. How am I going to sit through 90 minutes with no talking? And he said there wasn't a second where he wasn't intrigued, he wasn't stimulated, there wasn't something to watch, there wasn't something that was moving, something that was exciting, something that was funny. So collectively, sometimes I'm up there and I'm thinking, oh, I'm a bit boring in this bit. But it doesn't matter, because other people are doing other things that certainly are not boring. So it's a really surprisingly dense experience for the audience for 90 minutes.
Sharon, you are never boring, by the way. Always totally watchable. Is this going to go elsewhere? Do you think, are other people going to have the chance to see it?
I don't know. You'd have to speak to the producers about that. I think they're very excited about how it's being received, so that's always a good sign.
It's a fabulous show. Small Mouth Sounds. Sharon Millichip is one of the stars. Sharon, thank you very much.
It's been my absolute pleasure.
Well, that's another podcast from ABC Local Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.